The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Kirsten Ellsworth, a host for the Art Channel for the New Books Network. And today it is my great pleasure to be speaking with Donna Stein, author of The Empress and I, How an Ancient Empire Collected, Rejected, and Rediscovered Modern Art, published by Skira 2020. I'd like to introduce Donna Stein a little bit here. Donna Stein is a curator, essayist, writer. The book is her memoir. She is also the retired deputy director of the Venda Museum of the Cold War in Los Angeles. So she really, as you will learn, helped found two museums during her career. And Donna, maybe I should just let you start talking to us about your book and ask you the big question: how did you get involved in this grand adventure of moving to Tehran in 1974 and working on this museum?
Well, in 1972, I received a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts when I was working at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And I ended up taking, actually leaving the museum, and I spent 7 months traveling around the world. On that trip in early 1973, I arrived in Tehran, and that was my first time there. And I had an old friend from college who was married to an Iranian professor, and I stayed with her. And then I also had met at the Museum of Modern Art an intern from Iran who was a friend of mine by then. And she, you know, welcomed me, and I traveled around the country, and I met many people through my Iranian friend and my other college friend, and I visited Shiraz in Isfahan. And then I went on my way because I was studying the art and architecture of world's fairs and their cultural impact. So I ended up spending much of my time in Europe. In any case, I kept, you know, continuing my friendship with my Iranian contact. And I received a letter towards the fall of 74 asking me if I would be interested in working for the Queen's office where she was employed. And if so, it would be better for me to come to interview before the end of the year. Well, I was teaching and doing various other things at the time, but The last 2 weeks of the year in 74, I went to Iran again to interview. And I spent those weeks writing reports, going around, looking at art. I was introduced to a lot of people at that time also. And I was shown, I was actually shown the museum that they were building for the museum. I was known because of my work at the Museum of Modern Art as a graphic art specialist, prints and illustrated books. But I wanted to enlarge my portfolio in a way that would make sense. And I proposed at the time that I would become an advisor on Western acquisitions of works on paper, which meant drawings, prints, illustrated books, and photographs. And I was following actually what many museums around the world were starting to do, which was to group together works on paper because they were similar to store. They, were also an important aspect of an artist's career. And I thought that that would be my role. But beginning with that trip in 1974, when there was an art fair, the first international art fair in Tehran, I began to select works that were purchased that were paintings, drawings, paintings and sculptures. So from the beginning, really, even before I was hired fully, I was broadening out the mandate that they had given me. I actually started to work officially on February 15 in 1975. And I was living in New York at the time, and they asked me to stay there and to work from New York for a period of a couple of months. Well, that was extended till 4 months. And during that time, I was visiting dealers, auction houses, artist studios, private dealers, collectors, and workshops for prints, and selecting things that I thought would be of interest to the Iranian community. And by the time I actually had left Iran in 1974, it was clear to me that the museum would be a museum for international art and for Iranian contemporary art, and also that it would be a collection that would begin with Impressionism, which was what the Queen had asked. And I had seen at the time also what the museum looked like in terms of its outer structure. It wasn't finished inside, but at least I could walk through it and have a sense of what the galleries were going to be and how the museum would function. And so based on the knowledge that I had seen in Tehran and the reports that had been approved, which included an acquisition policy that I wrote, I started looking for things that could be part of the collection. And at the end of May in I greeted three Iranians. My main boss, who was the chief of the Queen's Secretariat, the former UN ambassador, who was a collector of art, and my friend, who was also a colleague in the Queen's office in her private secretariat. And so they came for 10 days, and in 10 days we bought, out of the works that I had set aside, 125 works in all media, prints, drawings, photographs, illustrated books, paintings, sculptures, and tapestries. It was an amazing 10 days. And I had, in 1974, we had started with acquisitions from the International Art Fair. And at that time, we had bought two sculptures and a painting by Giacometti, a canvas by Kandinsky, a sculpture by Braque, a mixed media work by Soto, and a painting by Hartung. I believe there may have been a couple of other things, but those were the main works that I remember. And then in New York, we bought things beginning with Impressionism and straight through to the contemporary period. For instance, knew very well Tatiana Grossman from Universal Limited Art Editions. And she was the primary printer of all the major artists, contemporary artists in America, and some from Europe as well. And as a result, we bought Rauschenbergs and Johns and Frankenthaler and Francis, Sam Francis, and many other artists that they handled and printed. And then at the dealers, we bought things like Picasso's painting from 1920. It was called The View Through the Window on the Rue de Penthièvre in Paris. And we bought a fantastic Derain painting from 1904, which was at another dealer's, and it was called The Golden Age. It was one of the first paintings that actually Iran lent to the Museum of Modern Art during their great Fauve show. So they were buying very substantial works in all media and beginning to form an exemplary collection that would, you know, hopefully fill out over time, which is what my acquisition policy recommended.
Just listening to the list of works is very impressive and compelling. And I would also like listeners to know that the book is beautifully illustrated with some of these pieces, imagery of some of these pieces. I'm wondering if you might tell us how the position that you kind of created for yourself or helped fashion, I guess, at the museum evolved over your time there. I know in the book there's some very interesting twists and turns in the story of what you were doing and what you wanted to do. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
You know, I was, as I mentioned, I was originally thought to be a specialist only in graphic arts, and I wanted to expand my portfolio. And when I started, I thought that I was going to actually work with someone on the building of the collection. That would have been my preference. But in fact, it ended up that I was the only one who was working with the chief of the Queen's office. And he was a man who had his PhD from USC, but wasn't in art. It was a subject completely unrelated, and he didn't really know much about art. So I considered it really my in order to make him understand what I was actually trying to achieve, and to understand the value of the works that I was presenting as possible acquisitions, that, you know, I had to teach him about the history of art, and certainly the modern art. And so every session when we met to go over works of art that were either presented to us, or which I had found through our connections or on auction, we would talk about the value of the work in terms of its rarity and its place in the history of art and its technique. And through the course of 2 years, he learned quite a lot and thanked me in the end for all of that. It was an incremental kind of change in my position, because he had to learn to trust me and know that I was, altruistic in my approach, that I was really trying to get the best for them and to follow what we had all agreed upon as the basis of my work. So I ended up working on several exhibitions. One was for the Nigaristan Museum. I was asked to do an exhibit of the print collection of the Empress. And that took me for the first time to Nyavaran Palace. And I went there on several occasions to catalog the works that she had and to be there for the photographer. And then I realized that, she had acquired things that she liked. And some of them were by, important artists, but not necessarily the most important work. But it was an opportunity to do the first exhibition of contemporary graphics in Iran. And so I made it into a kind of educational exhibition, a didactic one, and talked about print techniques. And it included the work not only of international artists like Vasarely and Chagall and Picasso, but also it included several Iranian artists, because she was a big supporter, of course, of the Iranian contemporary community. And so there were works by Tanav Ali and Arab Shahi and Mohassas and various other artists who were working at that time. I also worked on a big exhibition that was at the Basel Art Fair in 1976. And it was an exhibition of, I think, 36 contemporary Iranian artists. And I was part of a team of people who chose the artists and the works for the collection that was exhibited. And it was an opportunity for the Iranian artists to see their work in a global setting and to understand what the global market was. There was a very active art interested community in Iran. And during the time I was there, several new galleries opened. But the artists, only a few of the artists had really an international presence and dealers. And so they didn't have a real sense of what the value of their art was on a global stage. So this was an opportunity for them to participate and to also learn a lot about what the contemporary scene was around the world and not just in Iran. And then on top of that, the Queen's office took the artists and their families on a broad tour of various places in Europe to inform them more about what was going on elsewhere and for them to see some important sites, because a lot of the artists hadn't had an opportunity to travel that way.
Many levels to what you were doing, your collections policies, choosing works, providing some education and some networking. And I'm wondering, related to that, you come to that situation as an American woman. And I wonder, you know, what it was like being a woman doing this work at the time, living on your own in Tehran, how you made friends or how you were received.
Well, you know, it was an amazing place at that time. There was a real international community. People from all over the world were coming to Tehran because it was, you know, the most lively place, and there was a lot of money in Tehran, so a lot of building going on, and it was an exciting time to be there, actually. I lived in an apartment complex which had two towers around a plaza. It was central in the sort of middle of Tehran, so it was not a long walk to my office, or I could take a kind of jitney taxi if I wanted, that only went on one street in one direction. And you would yell out that you were going straight ahead, and the one or two taxis would try and get you to come into their taxi. And then you would tell them where you were getting off, what the cross street would be, and they would drop you off. Anyway, the advantage of where I live, besides having air conditioned and a properly heated apartment, it also had a great view of the Elbrus Mountains, which were very majestic and beautiful, and wonderful light. It was very small, but it was really just perfect. And the building had a 24-hour concierge, and it had on two levels, like a department store. It was a market. You could get there was a camera store. There were rug stores. There were various shops of every variety, and that was also convenient. So as a foreigner, it was a good place to live. And, I had some language. By the time I arrived in Iran, I was taking Farsi lessons in New York for 4 months. And so I could make my way, and I could ask for things and shop, but I couldn't have a real intelligent conversation. But it did help me. And then, of course, when I got there, I knew that I had to study more. And so I hired another tutor and continued to study for a time. And it was good for me to be able to understand certain things, to be able to read letters and numbers, to somehow converse. I found it easy to converse with children, for example, but or people in the countryside much more than in the city. And I also was curious what people were saying about me. So I could sort of eavesdrop a little bit and understand, which I thought was useful.
I can imagine, right? With all these different people you're meeting, and something that I really enjoyed in the book is the very honest description of certain kinds of encounters that, and your perception of people, and it just adds another dimension to this book about what it was like to be in Tehran at that time, whether one was working at a museum or not.
I was actually not working at a museum. I was working in an office in a kind of downtown Tehran, a very discreet office that had the Queen's insignia out front, but that's all. And the museum didn't open until 1977. So I never actually worked in the museum, or I only was a contractor for two or three exhibitions, which I did for the opening of the museum. So, I had some impact on aspects of how the museum was finished. And I had one of the things that I did that from the beginning was I was buying books for the first National Library of Art History. And I bought more than 10,000 books, art history books, that were, I think, eventually put in the library of the museum. But I hired two librarians. One was American and one was Iranian to catalog all the books that I had acquired.
One wonders where those books are now, which might lead us to what is the current state of affairs regarding the collection that you helped and were so important in creating there and helping them acquire as we speak? Where are these things?
Okay, well, the museum has a very large storage. And for most of the last 40 years, most of the collection has been in storage. It's come out for an exhibition in 1999, when there was an opening up and a more liberal government under Khatami, and then again in 2005 there was a large exhibition of the Western materials. But when the Islamic Revolution happened, the museum was closed down. And Khomeini was very against West toxification, and he was very firm that the artworks wouldn't be seen. And so it took a long while, before 10 years after he died, actually, before the museum was able to show the works in 1999. And The collection still remains mostly in storage. Things go out on loan to other countries. And indeed, I tried very hard in my the essay part of my book to talk about which works were exhibited and where they were exhibited outside of Iran and also in Iran, because in the last, 10 years or so, more and more works have been included in various exhibitions, even of Iranian artists, like Fereydeh Leshai had a retrospective, and her works were shown in conjunction with the Western objects, which was something that, you know, didn't happen too much before that time.
And so at a certain point in the memoir, you decide to leave. And maybe it's very interesting. We don't want to give everything away in the book, but why you chose to leave Tehran and how that went.
Okay. You know, When I went there, I got a 1-year contract, and I signed up for a second year. But shortly after I had my second contract, I also had a trip home for the first time to see family and friends, and it became very clear to me that there was only a limit to what I could expect to do in Tehran. And, the frustrations were great. It was not an easy job. It was the hardest job I've ever had. And so I decided on that trip that really I was not going to have a third, third year there. I felt that my 2 years were going to be sufficient. And I came back. It was probably summer of 76. And I was very busy. And then towards the end of that year, the architect for the museum, Cameron Debo, was named the director of the museum. And there was a change in government at the end of October of 76. And the man who had been my boss at the head of the Queen's office was became the Minister of Information in the Shah's cabinet. And another man, Dr. Nahavandi, became the director of the Queen's office. And I was put in a very strange position because the man who had brought me there was kind of my protector. And it was very awkward for me because I didn't know how I would actually be able to complete my work. And I was very concerned that the artworks would get damaged because they were left at customs and not brought to the Queen's office or to storage. So it was a very difficult time, those months. And I was just told I had to be patient. Well, I had to be patient until May. And then in May, even though that was 3 months after my second contract had expired, I was able to do the completion of my work. And then I was given the tax papers and customs papers that I needed in order to leave. So it was a very strange a moment in my work there. It's longer than a moment, months, where I was kind of baseball being thrown back and forth between four different people, the head of the Queen's office, the head of the Department of Arts and Culture, the director of the museum. Each one wanted something from me or didn't want something from me, and it was very hard. But I finally managed, and I decided I left at the end of May, went to Europe, came back again because I had a job in Tehran from Europe. And I came back in June, and then I went to New York. And I went back for the opening of the museum where I had two exhibitions, one on the history of photography collection and one on the graphic arts, prints, drawings, and books.
And yet the story really doesn't just end. I had the pleasure of speaking with you a little bit before we started the recording about whether you are still in contact with the Queen, the Shaba Anu, as she was known, Farah Diba. And throughout the book, it's clear that she's the support, a support behind the project. And you also have this wonderful photograph on the cover of yourself and the Queen. And I wondered if you might talk a little bit about the relationship you had and how you continue to be friends today.
Well, I would say that during the time that I was in Iran, I actually, she was a very big presence in my life. I mean, there were pictures of her everywhere in my office, in the building, and around the city. I went to a number of events that she was present at. But with royalty, you're not able to just go up and shake their hand and say hello. You have to be officially introduced. And I wasn't officially introduced, actually, until August of 76. And I had been working for the Iranians from February of 75. And I was invited at that time with about 10 other people to go with the Queen to the Shiraz Arts Festival, which was its 10th year. And it was known worldwide because it brought in the greatest avant-garde and also indigenous artists from countries around the world. And it was a kind of meeting of the artists. And it was done in various places all around Shiraz, including the ancient site of Persepolis. So it was very grand and very exciting. And we spent 3 days going to events, going to the bazaar, going to concerts at the Tomb of Hafez, all kinds of things that happened. And the last night, which was a formal event, a dinner, I was actually finally introduced to her. And she told me that she'd always thought of me as an old woman with glasses, that she didn't realize I was so young, attractive, and chic. So it was kind of very funny. And again reconnected with her when she was already in exile about 10 years in 1990. And I had a wonderful Iranian friend, and through her, I asked for an interview because I thought that what she had done had been so far in advance of anything in the Near and Middle East even till 1990. And way before, 3 decades before any of the museums that are now in Dubai and the other countries of the Emirates. And so I did this on the record interview, about 2.5 hours actually. And I had brought along with me the photographer, the feminist photographer, Judy Dater. And she did portraits of her as we talked. And I was able finally to publish just a small section of the long interview in 2013 in a book called Performing the Iranian State. And it was at that time that I really reconnected with her. And that we've, talked off and on through the years about various things that either she was interested in that I might know or that I was interested in and that she knew. And she was very kind when I was writing and, answered all my questions. And indeed, through these years, she's been saying to me, please write your book. I know you have these archives that you've kept. We need to have those, we need them to be out there for people to be aware of what went on. This was a passionate project for her. She loves art. And indeed, it wasn't the only museum that she started at the time. She started one for Luristan bronzes, for glassworks, for painted miniatures, for the Qajar period, which is 18th and 19th century art. And so she was committed to educating her populace. And she thought that by having artworks available for them to see and to understand and to know their national patrimony, that would be part of their education. The Shah in 1963 had something which he called the White Revolution, and it was a way to bring his populace to a more contemporary point of view. And changed the status of women. It made it possible for people to have to own land who had previously not been able to have land. The distribution was changed, And there was all kinds of industries that were taken over by the government. And it was a time where they focused on literacy. And when the Queen became very active in her role later in the 60s and in the 70s, she worked in the areas of social welfare, education, and culture. And so she thought that the arts were very important and really supported them very effectively.
And this compelling story that you tell in the book, it really does continue in these, spreading off in these different directions, as you've just described. And also we have the fact that there is still an art collection there. And the maybe the final question I'd like to ask you is, what are your hopes for that collection that was such a part of your life? What would you like to see happen with it?
Well, actually, I think they've begun to, they realize how important it is in terms of its value and interest. And what I tried to do is not just talk about the money value of things, which is in every article you read about the collection, but actually the aesthetic value and the importance of what the Queen actually did in terms of establishing the museum, of creating a dialogue between East and West, of her ability to have a kind of global perspective that was way in advance of what, you know, the current approach to globalism. And, you know, I think all of those things made her legacy pretty extraordinary and very much in advance of other countries from Central Asia and near the Near East. And it seems to me that because of what she did, they have not only a fabulous financial stockpile, but and they know that, which is why it's still there, but that they're actually taking care of it. They just renovated the museum. It took 30 months to completely redo it. They've put up a new website. The works are cataloged. They're actually publishing a 6-volume collection catalog corpus. And, you know, so I think what they're doing is pretty wonderful. And they're moving forward. And they have been lending works to museums in Scotland and England, in Japan, and other places. So I think that's good that the collection is taken care of well and it gets to be seen. And hopefully it'll be, exhibited more in, its own museum, in the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art. I was very excited to hear recently, because I have an Instagram account that's followed by many people who work at the museum. And you can message on Instagram. And I received a message, which was very surprising to me. It was my name that I had written in English and in Farsi. And then there was the logo of the Queen's office in a separate image. And I wrote back and I said, "Where did you find these?" And so I learned that all of my files that I had carefully made before I terminated my job there for each artwork, both in the Western collection and in the contemporary Iranian collection, that all of that is in the archive of the museum. So I was thrilled. I was really pleased to know that, you know, they're taking care of things and that they have kept the important things that we had established for the collection.
This is a very positive and exciting note on which to end. And it's a good ending, and I'm smiling.
That's very helpful, isn't it?
Yeah. And I'm sure listeners are thinking social media, Instagram, you know, there's another piece of the puzzle.
They're very savvy technically. You know, they're on social media all the time. It's fascinating.
Here's an example where sometimes we hear so much about negative elements of social media, and we can challenge that narrative. I really want to thank you for taking the time and giving us insight into this memoir. And just a reminder, everyone, the title of the book is The Empress and I, How an Ancient Empire Collected, Rejected, and Rediscovered Modern Art by Donna Stein, published by Skira in 2020. And I, again, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Kristen.